The Tom Woods Show, episode 1152.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, the Contra Cruise, hosted by Bob Murphy and me, which people absolutely rave about, is back for a third year. Featuring special guests Jeff Deist, Naomi Brockwell, and Brett Vanott, this year promises to be the best one yet. Great folks, great fun, an unforgettable time. Sign up at ContraCruise.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I just came across some material from my old days as a fill-in host on the Peter Schiff Show back when it was a traditional radio program. And this material is two interviews I did with Pat Buchanan, who is always interesting. Don't always agree with him, but he's always interesting. And in particular, I guess the first one is from 2011. And in that one, we're talking about his book, Suicide of a Superpower. And then in the second one, which I'll pop back in to introduce, it's a couple of years later, and we're just talking about current events. And it's interesting, that was 2013. So his thoughts about the prospects of Rand Paul and all the natural advantages he enjoyed are interesting in light of how the actual Rand Paul presidential campaign turned out. But anyway, of course, as you know, Pat's been on the show a number of times, but I'd hate to see this juicy material just sit there and not ever see the light of day again. So I thought, hey, what the heck? You know, I know you may be saying to yourself, Woods, how generous of you to be digging through this old material to find gems for us. And I know that was the first thought that went through your mind. It wasn't going through your mind. Is Woods just trying to take the day off today or something? Is that really what's happening? Absolutely not. I scoured the archives looking for material for you, and this is what I came up with. So anyway, I hope you enjoy these selections from my previous interviews with Pat Buchanan, and here we go. We are joined by Pat Buchanan, and if you don't know who Pat Buchanan is, I almost don't know what to do for you. But Pat is, of course, Pat worked in the Nixon and Reagan White Houses. He was a founding member of a McLaughlin Group, one of the great programs ever, as well as Capital Gang and Crossfire that I used to watch when I was younger. Made several memorable runs for president. I'll talk about that in a minute. And is a political analyst for MSNBC. And he has written his seventh consecutive New York Times bestseller, Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive in 2025? And that's what we want to talk to him about today. Pat Buchanan, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
How you doing, Tom?
I am doing great. It's fantastic to be talking to you. I'm grateful for all the kindnesses you've shown me over the years. And I want to just say before we get into your book that, not that you need this, but I believe you are one of the most, by far the most unjustly maligned person in American media and political life. And it's interesting to note, though, when I knew Frank Luntz a little bit in the pollster, right. We see on Fox a lot. In the early 90s, he spent a year at Harvard at the Kennedy School of Government as a fellow, and he worked for you briefly.
Right.
And it's interesting to note that here he was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where the most fashionable thing in the world would have been to trash Pat Buchanan. But every opportunity, whenever somebody mentioned your name, Luntz said, Pat Buchanan is the single nicest person I've ever worked with in politics. So I just want you to know there is still honor out there in the world. All right,
well,
before we get to your
kind.
Book, though, I just need you to indulge me on one thing. I want to know, in 1996, when you won the New Hampshire primary, and I was watching the news, and those newscasters, it was like their dog had just died, reporting that you had won the New Hampshire primary. I just want to know, what was going through your mind? Did you expect to win? Did you think that, wow, I mean, maybe this thing is just going to take off? What was going through your mind when you won that night?
Well, we knew we had a fighting chance. I had won Alaska, and I defeated Graham and sort of finished him off, who was the main competition for the conservative crown in Louisiana, and I'd come within three of Dole in Iowa. And if, you know, Alan Keyes had not been in, he got 8%, I think I would have won there. So we knew we had a fighting chance in New Hampshire. I had the union leader with me. We had a great organization and team. You didn't know you were going to win, but it was exhilarating. I tell you, it really was when they finally called it. I think we won that thing by one point, Tom. My friend, the late Sam Francis, who was probably more controversial than even I was, said, Pat, when the news came to D.C. about your victory in New Hampshire, Washington was like Paris when they heard Rommel had broken through in the Ardennes.
Good old Sam.
Good old Sam.
Now, I know your book is at number 4 on the New York Times bestseller list.
It was number 4 last Sunday. It'll be number 11 this Sunday. But they've got all these good books coming out, so I think I'm going to be 18 on the Sunday after this. But we've had 2 weeks in the top on the New York Times bestseller list, and hopefully we're still working at it, but there's an awful lot on there. But we're selling, these Kindle books are really selling like hotcakes, you know, Tom. It's a new thing. I was told by my publisher we've sold 10 times as many Kindle books in this book as we did Day of Reckoning, which was a bestseller in 2008. So, or 2007, I think. So it is really going great guns. We're very pleased with it. We'd always like to be a little bit, but you know, and we've been working very hard, but we've had a lot of people help us out and everything. So we're very fortunate and we're very pleased.
Well, as I was telling people before you came on, the best revenge in this world is especially as a writer, is just to keep churning out best-selling books. You know, they can call you all the names in the world they want to, but Pat Buchanan writes a book, it gets on the New York Times bestseller list. There aren't a lot of people who can say that. All right, let's get into the meat of the book. I mean, you're basically saying that in one way after another, in demographically, economically, religiously, internationally, with foreign policy, financially, we have seen and will continue to see wrenching changes of a kind that you wouldn't think a country would voluntarily impose on itself. And so what I want to do is, just so that we don't, there's so much to say, I don't want to just talk superficially about every little bit. I want to focus on a couple areas. First, I want to talk about, you have a chapter, The Long Retreat. I want to say a little something about foreign policy and the U.S. government and imperial overstretch. Where are we? Where do we stand right now? What's the mentality in Washington, bipartisan, regarding the U.S. role in the world and all that? And do you see any prospect of it changing?
Well, the elites in Washington of both parties do not like what is happening. They see the American people basically turning their back and saying goodbye to all that, to Iraq and Afghanistan, anxious to bring the troops home, no longer enthusiastic or even terribly interested in what is going on there. Because I think the elites in this town, candidly, want to use this IAEA report, Tom, to get the Americans to launch an attack on Iran, on their nuclear, on their embryonic nuclear facilities, such as they are. And so I think Washington is out of touch with the country. You see the Republican candidates not even talking about foreign policy because they know that Ron Paul's position, for example, has enormous resonance inside the conservative movement and the Republican Party, far greater than it did when I was arguing for bringing the troops home in the 1990s. And so that you've got a dichotomy there. But the reality is that the fiscal crisis, the financial crisis, is going to do what we should have done voluntarily ourselves at the end of the Cold War, which was wrap it up. I mean, we won the Cold War. The troops come home. They came home after World War I, and they came home after World War II. They only went back because of the rise of Stalin's empire and what it threatened. So I think that the bases are going to have to be closed. Cuts are coming in the military because there's nowhere else that the parties will agree to make any cuts. And so I think there's a certain inexorability here, but my guess is we're going to do it haphazardly rather than with any wisdom or strategically the way we should.
Do you think it's going to happen because there will be a fiscal crunch, or do you think people, I mean, I find that the biggest stumbling block people have with Ron Paul is the foreign policy. I love Ron Paul except for his foreign policy. I wish I saw more movement toward his position among Republicans and conservatives. So you'd think they would say there's nothing conservative about spreading feminism to Afghanistan. Like, what's complicated about this? Why aren't more of them getting it?
Well, I think what they fear is the base of the party. Well, the Republicans have been, all of us, or almost everyone, these young people, we're raised in a Cold War environment, that the America is the superpower. America is the one power in the world can use military force and has to maintain, what is right and good and just and all the rest. This is the way folks were raised, and it's very difficult to get them to change their thinking. I mean, with me, at the end of the Cold War in 1989, 1990, oddly, oddly, you know, Tom, you know, for the love the neocons bear me, oddly, it was Irving Kristol, almost mixed them up there, Irving Kristol, who was early on saying we should start bringing American troops home from Europe. You go back to Eisenhower, you read him in 1961, he's telling Kennedy, we've been over there 10 years, they're up on their feet, they're trading, their trade surpluses are bigger than ours, and now is the time to bring them home before they become dependencies. That's Eisenhower. Nixon talked about the Nixon Doctrine, that Asians would do the fighting in future Asian wars. And you get all of these people. MacArthur said, don't put your foot soldiers into Southeast Asia. I mean, these were strategic thinkers who realized America was an enormously powerful country, but we couldn't defend the whole world. And other countries had to be first responders.
All right, we're coming right back with Pat Buchanan here on the Peter Schiff Show, the gold standard in talk radio. We'll be talking about the future of America right here. All right, everybody, welcome back to the Peter Schiff Show. I'm Tom Woods in for Peter. We've got only one more segment with Pat Buchanan, so let's get right into it. We're talking about his brand-new book, the New York Times bestseller, Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive to 2025? Pat, do you think a Greece scenario is in our future, or is that an exaggeration?
No, I think it's Italy. Tom, I don't see how. Do you? I mean, take a look at the deadlock you got up on the Hill, the inability of the Congress. I mean, as we've discussed, I think some of these military bases are going to be shut, but the Congress is really resisting any real cuts in defense. And the Democrats aren't going to allow them to go after Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. And the other great society programs are a huge slice of the budget, but they're not going to be touched either, and you can't touch interest. So what I see going down the road is that the deficit adds to the national debt annually until you reach a point where people are going to believe that the Americans aren't going to pay back their loans with the dollars of the same value that they borrowed. And I think that's correct. So my guess is we're going to be heading down the road to inflation. Rogoff said we ought to have 6% inflation, and I guess the fellow up the New York Times, he says it all only ought to be 4%, but I think that's the way we're going to go.
Yeah, that's usually the debate they allow us to have. Should it be 6 or 4?
They're going to take 4% of everything earned every year, huh?
That's right. All right, let's shift.
Country, yeah.
Yeah, I know, exactly. It's probably one of the safest ones on earth, frighteningly enough. Let's talk a little, shift gears a little bit, because there's so many different topics to cover in here. You're talking in here about something called the diversity cult, and I can't believe this sounds like an un-American thing of you to say. I mean, diversity is our strength, and Americans have voluntarily embraced diversity. So what could you possibly mean by the diversity cult?
Well, what I mean by diversity cult is the worship of diversity per se. What makes America, what made America strong, for example, in our revolution, is when the diversity, the Quakers of Pennsylvania, the Cavaliers of Virginia, the Puritans of Boston, and the Scotch-Irish of Georgia and South Carolina, who didn't like anybody, they finally got together and said, we're not going to be able to win our freedom unless we're one, unless we're united. You know, what did Ben Franklin say? Let us all hang together, gentlemen, or we shall all hang separately. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. When you became one nation, one people under God, is when America became a great nation. What's happening now is we're importing folks from all over the world, from countries and continents, who have never before been assimilated in the United States. At the same time, we've thrown out the melting pot. At the same time, the whole world has begun to tear itself apart over religious fundamentalism and tribalism. Now, this is an act of insanity, and I don't know why we're doing it. There's no doubt that anybody can be a good American. But if you take a look, Tom, and you get into sensitive areas here, there were two peoples of color here in America at the time of the Revolution. There were the American Indians. How did the diversity work out for them? And then there were African Americans who were enslaved and then segregated for 100 years. And it took us centuries to work together and try to build us into one people, one nation, so that our ideas, our beliefs, our traditions, our history, our heroes, holidays, we all had things in common. And that's what we're losing. At the same time, we're bringing in millions of folks who have never been assimilated before.
But what do you say to people who say, well, it doesn't matter if we don't have anything in common? You know, we share in common a shared ideal, right? A shared commitment to the ideas of freedom and this and that. Doesn't that hold any water? Isn't this a nation dedicated to a proposition?
I don't think it does. I know that there's a neocon proposition that, you know, we're a propositional nation. This is Irving Kristol idea and the neocons. But the truth is, we don't agree at all on even what the Constitution says. Does the First Amendment say you can pray in public schools? Does it say you can have a Christmas display on the mall? Does it say you have to have a mosque down there at Times Square? What does the Ninth Amendment say about right to life? It says nothing. It says nothing, but the Supreme Court says it makes abortion on demand the law in all 50 states. We don't agree on our Constitution. We don't agree on what the word equality means. It used to mean equality of rights, constitutional and God-given. Now we say, you know, people are unequal in incomes, and so we got to have to equalize them. So what I'm saying is we don't agree on ideas anymore, and that's not enough to hold the people together. And you take a look at what's happening around the world, Tom, all over the world. I think what's happening to America is basically a Balkanization, just like in the Balkan Peninsula. People are moving away from one another and segregating and separating themselves ideologically, politically, racially, culturally, every way you can think of. I mean, it's not Pat Buchanan. It was the Attorney General Elder and the Orlando Patterson say that the self-segregation going on in the black community is astonishing, and social segregation is as great as it was in the 1950s. I can't argue with them. I mean, people in California, they show up at school and they're segregated immediately by race and tribe, and they get together in their own fraternities. And what we're losing is the things that hold us together. George Kennan was right. America's coming apart.
Pat, we've got just 2 minutes left before I'll have to go to a hard break. So I'm going to ask you something that's an unusual, an oddball question, but I think we are really in uncharted territory historically in the United States. So these oddball questions aren't so oddball anymore. Do you think in the next, say, 50 to 100 years, secession becomes a possibility for whatever reason? Do you think that is a plausible scenario?
Sure.
And in fact, you know what? I'll make you feel more comfortable. I'll be John McLaughlin and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being zero plausibility, 10 being metaphysical plausibility, where would you put it on the scale?
Very high, 8 or 9, and here's where it would go. Not in the South or something like that. I think the American Southwest, when you have 135 million Hispanics here, which you will at mid-century with their numbers growing, I think the Southwest culturally and socially becomes as much a part of Mexico as the United States. And we will become a really, truly a binational, bilingual country there. And those countries are breaking apart. And I think a real possibility that the United States could lose the Southwest for all practical purposes, sort of like the way that Serbia lost Kosovo.
What do you think the likelihood is that all the different policies you're talking about here, and now we've got about a minute, what's the likelihood that any of these policies that you argue are really eating away at the fabric from within will be reversed?
Well, there's some of them. You can on economics, you can do a lot of things like Reagan did on fiscal policy and things. But you take the decline of Christianity, which is documented there, and the Protestant and Catholic alike. You take the birth dearth, the rise of deaths over births. These things have been going on for 35 years now in Europe and the United States. I don't see them turned around. I see them, if anything, accelerating. The Islamization of Europe, I think, is inevitable. And I think of the United States, the decomposition of our society is already well advanced socially, you know, with the crime, illegitimacy, dropout rates, drug use, all these things, and the Hispanization of the American Southwest. I don't think we're going to stop them. I don't think, Tom, that, I mean, you got the Republican Party won't even talk about them. They're scared to death.
Pat, can you tell me in 15 seconds, are we going to see a Pat Buchanan memoir someday? Because that'd be something I'd be interested in reading.
Well, in my next one, I'm going to do my 8.5 years before the mast with Richard Nixon.
Oh, nice. Well, listen, Pat Buchanan, I really appreciate you taking
it. Patience has run out, Tom. We can write about it.
That's right. Thanks again, Pat, so much for being with us on the Peter Schiff Show. Pat Buchanan, everybody. The book is Suicide of a Superpower. Will America Survive to 2025?
All right, and here is my discussion with Pat a couple of years later, and we are joining it in progress.
And we are back on the Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter, joined by Pat Buchanan, whom you all know and who is the author most recently of Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive to 2025? We had him on this program to talk about that. He is the well-known political commentator, author, syndicated columnist, politician, and broadcaster. Pat Buchanan, welcome to the Peter Schiff Show.
How you doing, Tom?
Very, very well. I'm very glad to be talking to you once again.
Good to talk with you. How's life out there? And where is it? Oklahoma.
Well, I live in Topeka, Kansas, but my wife is from Oklahoma. Okay. Who knew I would be in the heartland
Little
of America?
America.
That's right. That's right. Well, we're hanging on all right out here, trying to resist the best we can the onslaught of the of our betters in D.C. But at some point I want to talk about what's going on in the GOP right now and Peter King flinging insults at Rand Paul and Chris Christie and all that. But I want to start off with Obama and Russia and Putin and Snowden. How do you think he's handling this whole situation? He said on the Jay Leno program that he felt like Russia was acting in a kind of a Cold War mentality spirit. What do you think about all this?
Well, you know, I've just got in my typewriter, or my machine here, a column titled "An Apologia Pro Vladimir Putin."
Nice. Okay, let's hear it.
It leads off with that quote: "There have been times when they slip back into Cold War thinking and a Cold War mentality," said Obama. Now, my view is that the Russians, they are very miffed with the United States for a variety of reasons, and they've taken this small opportunity to do what they think they've got a right to do, which they know is going to antagonize the Americans, and they're doing it. But I don't think we ought to make too big a deal out of this with the Russians. I think I can understand, and I think the American people and the American nation's got to understand what the Russians have gone through and how Putin sees the United States of America, you know, moving NATO right up to its borders, bringing in the three Baltic republics, trying to bring in Ukraine and Georgia into NATO, cutting them out of the Caspian Sea oil through that pipeline, sending the National Endowment for National Endowment for Democracy and its agents into his country. I think they think the United States has been treating them contemptuously, and they're responding in kind. And I think the United States, from our side, our problem is we ought to take a real cold look and try to see the world from their point of view.
Well, that seems to be the difficulty in all areas of U.S. foreign policy, that the U.S. government is just arbitrarily put upon by irrational bad guys everywhere for no good reason other than we're wonderful and we march against breast cancer and do all these wonderful things, and they just can't stand that. And the result has been this horrifying foreign policy and the righteousness behind it. It's interesting that even Russell Kirk back in 91 gave this great speech at the Heritage Foundation where he condemned this kind of spirit, this haughty spirit of our government is always right, and yet he would be called a pinko commie by the neocons today.
Exactly. He was talking about the hubris that had taken over America in the wake of its Cold War victory. Now, I don't believe Reagan would have behaved this way toward Putin, and Nixon certainly would not have done so. But let's take a look at they say that Putin is defying us in Syria. What is he doing in Syria? I'm not a fan of President Assad, but he's been a long time ally of the Russians. They have a naval base of some kind at Latakia. They've sold him weapons, and Assad is under assault from rebels, which include the Al-Qaeda terrorists, who are the dominant force there. And the Russians are standing by their ally, as we did not stand by ours, Mubarak, and when we helped dump him over. And why should they adapt their policy toward American policy when their own interests, as they see them, mean consistency with what they have been going for the last 20 years? Again, we don't seem to be able to understand things from their point of view, and Putin's got a good question when he asks, why are you Americans supporting rebels whose leading fighting force are the very people who brought down the Twin Towers?
These are good questions. These are good questions for John McCain.
The McCainiacs, as I've called them. Did you see what McCain said? I'm going to have to dig it up. But McCain said, look, if they let Snowden in, let's bring Georgia into NATO. In other words, threaten them.
Yeah.
A possible world war.
Yeah, I know it. I know. Did you happen to see, Pat, that column in the Washington Times a few days ago in which Gingrich said that the neocons really have to do some soul searching over the complete how their interventionist policies have completely backfired overseas? Did you see that?
I did. It said he's Newt's converting on this front as well, I think. But exactly, isn't this not a valid question? We just, Tom, we just got what the other day? We said, you know, 22 embassies got to be shut down. Al-Qaeda is all over the place. They're threatening our people. And so we go into our fortresses over there. First, Obama has said that, you know, Al-Qaeda was on the run. Secondly, we just lost, in the last decade, 6,000 soldiers, 40,000 wounded, lost $2 trillion, you know, killed hundreds of thousands of people, created a million widows and orphans in Afghanistan and Iraq in the, quote, war on terror. And now the enemy's in more places than it was when the war begun. I mean, does that not ask the question, what were these wars all about?
That, to me, is the best way to spin it. I've had a lot of success talking to people who I think are, some of them are in good faith, just conservatives who just listen to conservative leaders and they adopt the views that they learn there. But look at the results. You know a tree by its fruits. And the results unless the purpose is to build up Islamic radicalism, then it's been a unmitigated success.
Well, exactly. I mean, Al-Qaeda they believe in killing civilians, killing innocents. They're a dreadful bunch of people, but there's no doubt about it. What is their goal? Why are they, were they over here? They are over here because we are over there. I mean, they see us as a colonial power, a dominant superpower, a secular power, a Christian power, inside their own countries and their own region, dominating them, and they can't get us out of their region. And so they came over here and engaged in acts of terrible terrorism against us. And the very then our response was to re-up what we were doing, which was the cause of the attack. We intervened massively in Afghanistan, massively in Iraq, and all over that region, and we created more terrorists than we're killing. And, I mean, people were asking these questions 10 years ago. If we go over there, will we create more enemy than we kill? And if you look at what's happening in the last week, where it's no longer in Tora Bora, but Al-Qaeda's in half a dozen countries over there, we have created more enemy than we have killed.
We're talking to Pat Buchanan. Buchanan.org is the website. You can follow him on Twitter, at Patrick Buchanan. Before we go to the break, Pat, I want to ask you one quick thing before we talk about the GOP. I want to ask you, it's 1992, you've run a strong insurgent campaign against a sitting president, and then you're at that Republican convention and you're handing over your supporters to George H.W. Bush. Does Pat Buchanan in 2013, does even 5% of Pat Buchanan, looking back at that, say to himself, I should have told him to go stick it?
No, because we did that in 2000 and it didn't work out well.
it never does. But you'll go down in history as a hero for having tried it. All right, can you stand by for one more segment after this break?
Okay.
All right.
Sure.
All right, we're coming right back with Pat Buchanan. We're going to talk about Rand Paul and the future of the GOP. That's next on the Peter Schiff Show. Don't go away.
The Peter Schiff Show.
You've heard of Karl Marx, right? Well, now, meet his worst nightmare. This is The Peter Schiff Show.
All right, welcome back to The Peter Schiff Show. Tom Woods in for Peter. Peter's out of town, but I guess Pat Buchanan and I are the second worst nightmare of Karl Marx. Pat, Rand Paul, I just played a clip, beginning of this program, from your old friend at MSNBC, Chris Matthews, just the other day, mm-hmm. in which he predicted... It's very early to say this, obviously, but that Rand would actually wind up being the nominee in 2016. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think if Rand runs, I would see Rand as running stronger than his father. For a variety of reasons, he's a United States senator now. He's much younger. His positions are more nuanced and not as stark as those of Ron Paul. But at this point, I think it's a possibility. And I would certainly put him up in the very top tier of the candidates to get the nomination, because I think his appeal is going to be very good in New Hampshire. Iowa is more of a socially conservative state, as is South Carolina. But clearly, I think Rand Paul is I think he's going to do very well, and he's going to have a real impact, and I think he already is. He's becoming the lead spokesman voice right now of sort of the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, but I think it needs a traditionalist conservative appendage in order to win the nomination.
What do you think about Congressman Peter King, who's just been on the rampage against Rand Paul? The other day he said Rand Paul has set the Republican Party back 50 years, which I think it was probably marginally better.
Eisenhower's time, we didn't do badly.
Yeah, that's right. And 50 years ago, they were on the verge of nominating Goldwater. So, I mean, you know, the worst things could happen.
Exactly. And Goldwater, I will say this is when I'm working on a book, Tom, on Nixon, and it deals with 65 to 69 when we put together the 49 state landslides of the next 20 years. But Peter King is, he's a very hard-line foreign policy guy, very strongly, pro-Israel. He's very strongly national security, and he's very much an interventionist. And, well, he's not a neoconservative. He's an old-line conservative. I think his views are very Cold War-oriented. I think Rand Paul is much more in line with where America is going tomorrow, and Peter King is much more aligned with America's been yesterday. And I think the idea that he's denouncing the libertarian trend in the Republican Party, I think is a denunciation of where the country and the party are going to a great degree.
And of course, we can overstate the extent to which Rand Paul is a libertarian. I mean, he uses the word libertarian from time to time, but in his campaign, he denied he was a libertarian, and he's reassured social conservatives that he is not intending to legalize heroin in their neighborhoods and things of this nature. So that aspect of him, I think, has been overstated. I think clearly what King and others are upset about is the fact that he may not be on board for the next half dozen wars that the neocons might want to cook.
Well, exactly. And Rand, it's his anti-interventionism, I think, that bothers the neoconservatives who dominate the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, and to whom a number of congressmen up there respond almost reflexively. And I think at one point Rand Paul suggested maybe we should worry more about the streetlights that aren't going on, 60% of them don't work in Detroit, rather than shipping off $5 billion a year to the Middle East after we've borrowed it from China. And so I think these arguments are really, they grate against the neoconservative dominance, the McCain, Lindsey Graham, if you will, who are the visible voices of the party, but whom nobody is following anymore.
Right. No, absolutely. And especially the younger audience who are internet savvy. When every time McCain makes some inane remark, which is, you know, not exactly something you record on your calendar, but his Facebook page is absolutely lit up with people denouncing him. Hardly anybody defends him. So
look on the intervention in the desire to get the United States to intervene militarily in Syria. Mm. The American people don't want it. The Republicans don't want it. Conservatives don't want it. No one wants to get involved in another Middle East civil war when we see the terrible consequences of the last two wars we've been in Iraq and Afghanistan. In the latter, the Taliban are making a comeback, and in the former, the country's breaking up in sectarian and civil war. How many people are going to say all those dead and wounded and all those trillions invested were really wisely invested?
Well, somebody like McCain would say that we had Iraq won, and then we just lost the will. I mean, what do you say to that?
Look, what they're saying, in effect, is the thing wouldn't have gone to hell in a handbasket if we'd stayed there for 100 years.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that was his thing.
But look, I mean, Americans decided finally that the bleeding and the dying simply weren't worth it in terms of what we were getting from it. And I think they made a wise decision there.
We've got just a few minutes left. I'd just like to ask you, in light of the fact that Iran has new leadership now, what do you think is going on in terms of U.S. policy with Iran? It really has quieted down.
Well, I think Netanyahu is beside himself. He's in the New York Times again this morning, or the Washington Post, denouncing Rouhani and saying they're starting up a new separate nuclear program. What's happened is the Iranian people, by electing Someone who, I mean, a moderate may not be the proper term. He's very close to the Ayatollah. But someone who is committed to getting sanctions lifted, to reintegrating Iran back with the world and the world community, and to negotiating his nuclear program with the Europeans and with the United States. I mean, what the Israelis want, and the Israeli lobby wants, and the neocons want, and McCainiacs want, is a war on Iran. And this individual, I think, offers a real possibility, because if to deliver on what he's promised, he's got to cut a deal on his nuclear program, and the Americans have some guidelines, red lines that have to be met. I think it's an extraordinarily hopeful sign, and the real fear back here is that, on my part certainly, is that somehow they're going to, you know, block any kind of deal, any kind of negotiation, any kind of U.S.-Iranian deal, which I think could bring an end to this, 35 years of hostile and antagonistic relations.
Well, we can certainly hope that that will happen. That was my interpretation as well. Let me ask you in our final minute, I was going to ask you anyway whether you were working on a book. Is this book that you mentioned, is this the beginning of the multi-volume Buchanan memoir that we'd all like to read?
Well, I was going to do a book on Nixon, and I decided it's too big a book to do the comeback and the presidential years, and I don't want to get into the whole thing, but I do think this is the first book. Hopefully, I'll be able to write another one on all the major events in the Nixon White House years in which I was involved, the Cambodian invasion, the Agnew speeches, the Great Silent Majority, Watergate, China trip, the rest of it. But this is on, Tom, it's on the how we built the new majority out of the wreckage and ruin of 1964-65, because out of that, as you know, back in those days, we might have gotten wiped out. But there was a real remnant out there of strong, solid conservative support and a movement which had been burned. At the same time, Nixon could deal with the Republican center. And all we had to do was carve away those Catholics in the North and the Southern Protestants from the Democratic Party, and we could build a new majority, and this is how we did it.
Well, Pat, we will look forward to reading that. We're out of time, but I'm so grateful to you for your generosity this morning with your time. Thanks for being here.
Talk to you, Tom.
All right, everybody, do not, under any circumstances, turn off this episode, because you're going to love this particular story. There's a website out there called 99recipesfor99cents.com, and it's taking a book from 1962 that was something of an underground classic. It sold 14,000 copies, largely through word of mouth, which, if you've been involved in book publishing at all, you know that is a miracle. Even with major, major marketing campaigns, most books don't even hit 1,000 copies. They don't even come close to 1,000 copies, contrary to what most people think. They think you write a book and it sells 1,000,000 copies. No, it doesn't. Most of them sell about 200 copies. So this is a minor miracle. Well, it was two authors, and the idea is that it's just full of good old-fashioned home-style meals, but also the occasional more exotic dish for a dinner party. All of that can be found in 99 recipes for 99 cents. Well, what I love about it is one of the authors, it's her son who went to the trouble of putting up the website, and he included a note from her just as she celebrated her 89th birthday. And in the PS, after she describes what the book is all about, she says, "Here we are in 2018. I'm now 89 years old, and my children have put my little 99 recipes cookbook onto the internet. I've never touched a computer in my life, and I don't understand any of it. When they told me, I said, 'But we don't have any more of the books to sell.' Then they explained that each person who buys the book will read it on their cell phone or print it for themselves at home with their own, quote, printing press. How is that possible?" She says, "To everyone who buys my little 99 recipes cookbook over the internet, I hope you enjoy the recipes as much as everyone did back in the 1960s and 70s, and I wish you bon appetit." So, how can you not check that out? 99recipesfor99cents.com. That was the original title back in 1962. And so thanks to the internet and ebooks, they're able to afford to sell it for 99 cents in 2018 as well. Even when the 99 cents don't amount to as much, they can still get away with doing it simply because the cost cutting of the internet has, in this case, managed to offset the inflation from the Fed. So tremendous. 99recipesfor99cents.com is the website. You can get a nice shout out like this, plus many bonuses, including membership in my private bloggers group that will help save you a lot of grief when you have that occasional difficult question to overcome. How do you get these bonuses? Make sure you get your hosting through my link. So get all the details on the bonuses and how to get them at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, original material coming your way tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.